the shifts of voting strength within the Landsrat as it balanced itself against the Emperor and his supporters.
"The Duke Leto," Peiter said, "may attempt to flee to the new Fremen scum along the desert's edge. Or he may try to send his family into that imagined security. But that path is blocked by one of His Majesty's agents, the planetary ecologist. You may remember him. Kynes."
"Fade remembers him," the Baron said. "Get on with it."
"You do not drool very prettily, Baron," Peiter said.
"Get on with it, I command you," the Baron roared.
Peiter shrugged.
"If matters go as planned," he said, "House Harkonnen will have a sub-fief on Arrakis within a standard year. Your uncle will have dispensation of that fief. His own personal agent will rule on Arrakis."
"More profits," Fade Rautha said.
"Indeed,"
the Baron said, and he thought, "It's only just. We're the ones who tamed Arrakis, except for the few mongrel Fremen hiding in the skirts of the desert, and some tame smugglers bound to the planet almost as quickly as the pool.
And the great houses will know that the Baron has destroyed the Atreides," Peiter said. "They will know."
"They will know," the Baron breathed.
"Loveliest of all," Peiter said, "is that the Duke will know too. He knows now. He can already feel the trap."
"It's true the Duke knows," the Baron said, and his voice held a note of sadness. "Would not help, though."
Dune, Disc 2.
Thus spoke St. Alia of the Knife. The Reverend Mother must combine the seductive wiles of a courtesan with the untouchable majesty of a virgin goddess, holding these attributes in tension so long as the powers of her youth endure. For when youth and beauty have gone, she will find that the place between, once occupied by tension, has become a wellspring of cunning and resourcefulness. From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries, by the Princess Irulan.
"Well, Jessica, what have you to say for yourself?" asked the Reverend Mother.
It was near sunset at Castle Caladan on the day of Paul's ordeal. The two women were alone in Jessica's morning room while Paul waited in the adjoining soundproofed meditation chamber. Jessica stood facing the south windows. She saw, and yet did not see, the evening's banked colours across meadow and river. She heard, and yet did not hear, the Reverend Mother's question. There had been another ordeal once, so many years ago. A skinny girl with hair the colour of bronze, her body tortured by the winds of puberty, had entered the study of the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, Proctor Superior of the Bene Gesserit School on Wallach 9. Jessica looked down at her right hand, flexed the fingers, remembering the pain, the terror, the anger.
"Poor Paul," she whispered.
"I asked you a question, Jessica,"
the old woman's voice was snappish, demanding.
"What? Oh."
Jessica tore her attention away from the past, faced the Reverend Mother, who sat with back to the stone wall between the two west windows.
"What do you want me to say?"
"What do I want you to say? What do I want you to say?"
The old voice carried a tone of cruel mimicry.
"So I had a son," Jessica flared, and she knew she was being goaded into this anger deliberately.
"You were told to bear only daughters to the Atreides."
"It meant so much to him," Jessica pleaded.
"And you, in your pride, thought you could produce the Kwisatz Haderach."
Jessica lifted her chin. "I sensed the possibility."
"You thought only of your Duke's desire for a son," the old woman snapped. "And his desires don't figure in this. An Atreides' daughter could have been wed to a Harkonnen heir and sealed the breach. You've hopelessly complicated matters. We may lose both bloodlines now."
"You're not infallible," Jessica said.
She braved the steady stare from the old eyes. Presently the old woman muttered,
What's done is done.
I vowed never to regret my decision, Jessica said.
How noble,
the Reverend Mother sneered.
No regrets. We shall see when you're a fugitive, with a price on your head, and every man's hand turned against you to seek your life and the life of your son.
Jessica paled. Is there no alternative?
Alternative? A Bene Gesserit should ask that.
I ask only what you see in the future with your superior abilities.
I see in the future what I've seen in the past. You well know the pattern of our affairs, Jessica. The race knows its own mortality and fears stagnation of its heredity. It's in the bloodstream, the urge to mingle genetic strains without plan. The Imperium, the Chome Company, all the great houses, they are but bits of flotsam in the path of the flood.
Chome, Jessica muttered. I suppose it's already decided how they'll redivide the spoils of Arrakis.
What is Chome but the weather vane of our times, the old woman said. The Emperor and his friends now command 59.65% of the Chome directorship's votes. Certainly they smell profits. And likely as others smell those same profits, his voting strength will increase. This is the pattern of history, girl.
That's certainly what I need right now, Jessica said, a review of history.
Don't be facetious, girl. You know as well as I do what forces surround us. We've a three-point civilization. The Imperial Household, balanced against the federated great houses of the Lancerad. And between them, the Guild, with its damnable monopoly on interstellar transport. In politics, the tripod is the most unstable of all structures. It'd be bad enough without the complication of a feudal trade culture which turns its back on most science.
Jessica spoke bitterly. Chips in the path of the flood. And this chip here, this is the Duke Leto, and this one's his son, and this one's...
Oh, shut up, girl! You entered this with full knowledge of the delicate edge you walked.
I am Bene Gesserit. I exist only to serve, Jessica quoted.
Truth, the old woman said. And all we can hope for now is to prevent this from erupting into general conflagration, to salvage what we can of the key bloodlines.
Jessica closed her eyes, feeling tears press out beneath the lids. She fought down the inner trembling, the outer trembling, the uneven breathing, the ragged pulse, the sweating of the palms. Presently she said, I'll pay for my own mistake.
And your son will pay with you.
I'll shield him as well as I'm able.
Shield, the old woman snapped. You well know the weakness there. Shield your son too much, Jessica, and he'll not grow strong enough to fulfill any destiny.
Jessica turned away, looked out the window at the gathering darkness. Is it really that terrible, this planet of Arrakis?
Bad enough, but not all bad. The Missionaria Protectiva has been in there and softened it up somewhat.
The Reverend Mother heaved herself to her feet, straightened a fold in her gown.
Call the boy in here. I must be leaving soon.
Must you? The old woman's voice softened.
Jessica, girl, I wish I could stand in your place and take your sufferings. But each of us must make her own path.
I know.
You're as dear to me as any of my own daughters. But I cannot let that interfere with duty.
I understand the necessity.
What you did, Jessica, and why you did it, we both know. But kindness forces me to tell you there's little chance your lad will be the Bene Gesserit totality. You mustn't let yourself hope too much.
Jessica shook tears from the corners of her eyes. It was an angry gesture. You make me feel like a little girl again, reciting my first lesson. She forced the words out. Humans must never submit to animals. A dry sob shook her. In a low voice, she said, I've been so lonely.
It should be one of the tests, the old woman said. Humans
are almost always lonely. Now summon the boy. He's had a long, frightening day, but he's had time to think and remember, and I must ask the other questions about these dreams of his."
Jessica nodded, went to the door of the meditation chamber, opened it.
"Paul, come in now, please."
Paul emerged with a stubborn slowness. He stared at his mother as though she were a stranger. Wariness veiled his eyes when he glanced at the Reverend Mother, but this time he nodded to her, the nod one gives an equal. He heard his mother close the door behind him.
"Young man," the old woman said, "let's return to this dream business."
"What do you want?"
"Do you dream every night?"
"Not dreams worth remembering. I can't remember every dream, but some are worth remembering and some aren't."
"How do you know the difference?"
"I just know it." The old woman glanced at Jessica, back to Paul.
"What did you dream last night? Was it worth remembering?"
"Yes." Paul closed his eyes. "I dreamed a cavern, and water, and a girl there. Very skinny, with big eyes. Her eyes are all blue. No whites in them. I talk to her and tell her about you, about seeing the Reverend Mother on Caladan." Paul opened his eyes.
"And the thing you tell this strange girl about seeing me, did it happen today?"
Paul thought about this, then,
"Yes.
I tell the girl you came and put a stamp of strangeness on me."
"Stamp of strangeness,"
the old woman breathed. And again she shot a glance at Jessica, returned her attention to Paul.
"Tell me truly now, Paul. Do you often have dreams of things that happen afterward exactly as you dreamed them?"
"Yes. And I've dreamed about that girl before."
"Oh? You know her?"
"I will know her."
"Tell me about her."
Again, Paul closed his eyes.
"We're in a little place in some rocks where it's sheltered. It's almost night, but it's hot, and I can see patches of sand out of an opening in the rocks. We're waiting for something, for me to go meet some people, and she's frightened but trying to hide it from me, and I'm excited. And she says, 'Tell me about the waters of your homeworld, Usul.'"
Paul opened his eyes.
"Isn't that strange? My homeworld's Caladan. I've never even heard of a planet called Usul."
"Is there more to this dream?" Jessica prompted.
"Yes, but maybe she was calling me Usul," Paul said. "I just thought of that."
Again he closed his eyes.
"She asks me to tell her about the waters, and I take her hand, and I say, 'I'll tell her a poem,' and I tell her the poem, but I have to explain some of the words, like beach and surf and seaweed and seagulls."
"What poem?"
the Reverend Mother asked. Paul opened his eyes.
"It's just one of Gurney Halleck's tone poems for sad times."
Behind Paul, Jessica began to recite. "I remember salt smoke from a beach fire, and shadows under the pines, solid, clean, fixed. Seagulls perched at the tip of land, white upon green. And a wind comes through the pines to sway the shadows. The seagulls spread their wings, lift and fill the sky with screeches. And I hear the wind blowing across our beach, and the surf, and I see that our fire has scorched the seaweed."
"That's the one," Paul said.
The old woman stared at Paul, then,
"Young man, as a proctor of the Bene Gesserit, I seek the Kwisatz Haderach, the male who truly can become one of us. Your mother sees this possibility in you, but she sees with the eyes of a mother. Possibility I see too, but no more."
She fell silent, and Paul saw that she wanted him to speak. He waited her out. Presently she said,
"As you will, then. You've depths in you, that I'll grant."
"May I go now?" he asked. "Don't you want to hear what the Reverend Mother can tell you about the Kwisatz Haderach?" Jessica asked. "She said those who tried for it died."
"But I can help you with a few hints at why they failed," the Reverend Mother said.
She talks of hints, Paul thought. She doesn't really know anything. And he said, "Hint, then."
"And be damned to me?"
She smiled wryly, a crisscross of wrinkles in the old face.
"Very well. That which submits rules."
He felt astonishment. She was talking about such elementary things as tension within meaning. Did she think his mother had taught him nothing at all?
"That's a hint?" he asked. "We're not here to bandy words or quibble over their meaning," the old woman said. "The willow submits to the wind and prospers until one day it is many willows, a wall against the wind. This is the willow's purpose."
Paul stared at her. She said, "purpose," and he felt the word buffet him, reinfecting him with terrible purpose. He experienced a sudden anger at her, fatuous old witch with her mouthful of platitudes. "You think I could be this Kwisatz Haderach?" he said. "You talk about me, but you haven't said one thing about what we can do to help my father. I've heard you talking to my mother. You talk as though my father were dead. Well, he isn't."
"If there were a thing to be done for him, we'd have done it," the old woman growled. "We may be able to salvage you. Doubtful, but possible. But for your father, nothing. When you've learned to accept that as a fact, you've learned a real Bene Gesserit lesson."
Paul saw how the words shook his mother. He glared at the old woman. How could she say such a thing about his father? What made her so sure? His mind seethed with resentment. The Reverend Mother looked at Jessica.
"You've been training him in the way. I've seen the signs of it. I'd have done the same in your shoes, and devil take the rules."
Jessica nodded.
"Now I caution you," said the old woman, "to ignore the regular order of training. His own safety requires the voice. He already has a good start in it, but we both know how much more he needs, and that desperately."
She stepped close to Paul, stared down at him.
"Goodbye, young human. I hope you make it. But if you don't, well, we shall yet succeed."
Once more she looked at Jessica, a flicker sign of understanding passed between them. Then the old woman swept from the room, her robes hissing, with not another backward glance. The room and its occupants already were shut from her thoughts. But Jessica had caught one glimpse of the Reverend Mother's face as she turned away. There had been tears on the seamed cheeks. The tears were more unnerving than any other word or sign that had passed between them this day.
You have read that Muad'Dib had no playmates his own age on Caladan. The dangers were too great, but Muad'Dib did have wonderful companion teachers. There was Gurney Halleck, the troubadour warrior. You will sing some of Gurney's songs as you read along in this book. There was Thufir Hawat, the old Mentet master of assassins, who struck fear even into the heart of the Padishah Emperor. There were Duncan Idaho, the swordmaster of the Ginas, Dr. Wellington Yui, a name black in treachery, but bright in knowledge. The Lady Jessica, who guided her son in the Bene Gesserit way. And, of course, the Duke Leto, whose qualities as a father have long been overlooked. From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Thufir Hawat slipped into the training room of Castle Caladan, closed the door softly. He stood there a moment, feeling old and tired and storm-leathered. His left leg ached where it had been slashed once in the service of the old Duke.
Three generations of them now, he thought. He stared across the big room, bright with the light of noon pouring through the skylights, saw the boy, seated with back to the door, intent on papers and charts spread across an L-table. How many times must I tell that lad never to settle himself with his back to a door? Howatt cleared his throat. Paul remained bent over his studies. A cloud shadow passed over the skylights. Again, Howatt cleared his throat. Paul straightened, spoke without turning. I know. I'm sitting with my back to a door. Howatt suppressed a smile, strode across the room. Paul looked up at the grizzled old man who stopped at a corner of the table. Howatt's eyes were two pools of alertness in a dark and deeply seamed face. I heard you coming down the hall, Paul said, and I heard you open the door.
The sounds I make could be imitated.
I'd know the difference.
He might at that, Howatt thought. That witch mother of his is giving him the deep training, certainly. I wonder what her precious school thinks of that. Maybe that's why they sent the old proctor here to whip our dear Lady Jessica into line.
Howatt pulled up a chair across from Paul, sat down facing the door. He did it pointedly, leaned back and studied the room. It struck him as an odd place, suddenly, a stranger place, with most of its hardware already gone off to Arrakis. A training table remained, and a fencing mirror with its crystal prisms quiescent, the target dummy beside it, patched and padded, looking like an ancient foot soldier maimed and battered in the wars.
There stand I, Howatt thought.
Thufir, what are you thinking? Paul asked. Howatt looked at the boy.
I was thinking we'll all be out of here soon and likely never see the place again.
Does that make you sad?
Sad? Nonsense. Parting with friends is a sadness. A place is only a place.
He glanced at the charts on the table.
And Arrakis is just another place.
Did my father send you up to test me? Howatt scowled. The boy had such observing ways about him. He nodded.
You're thinking it'd have been nicer if he'd come up himself. But you must know how busy he is. He'll be along later.
I've been studying about the storms on Arrakis.
The storms, I see.
They sound pretty bad.
That's too cautious a word, bad. Those storms build up across 6,000 or 7,000 kilometers of flatlands, feed on anything that can give them a push. Coriolis force, other storms, anything that has an ounce of energy in it. They can blow up to 700 kilometers an hour, loaded with everything loose that's in their way, sand, dust, everything. They can eat flesh off bones and etch the bones to slivers.
Why don't they have weather control?
Arrakis has special problems. Costs are higher, and there'd be maintenance and the like. The Guild wants a dreadful high price for satellite control, and your father's house isn't one of the big rich ones, lad. You know that.
Have you ever seen the Fremen?
The lad's mind is darting all over today,
Howatt thought.
Like as not, I have seen them, he said. There's little to tell them from the folk of the Graben and Sink. They all wear those great flowing robes, and they stink to heaven in any closed space. It's from those suits they wear, call them still suits, that reclaim the body's own water.
Paul swallowed, suddenly aware of the moisture in his mouth, remembering a dream of thirst. That people could want so for water, they had to recycle their body moisture, struck him with a feeling of desolation. Water's precious there, he said. Howatt nodded, thinking,
perhaps I'm doing it, getting across to him the importance of this planet as an enemy. It's madness to go in there without that caution in our minds.
Paul looked up at the skylight, aware that it had begun to rain. He saw the spreading wetness on the grey metaglass. Water, he said.
You'll learn a great concern for water, Howatt said. As the Duke's son, you'll never want for it, but you'll see the pressures of thirst all around you.
Paul wet his lips with his tongue, thinking back to the day a week ago and the ordeal with the Reverend Mother. She, too, had said something about water starvation. "You'll learn about the funeral plains," she'd said, "about the wilderness that is empty, the wasteland where nothing lives except the spice and the sandworms. You'll stain your eye pits to reduce the sun glare. Shelter will mean a hollow out of the wind and hidden from view. You'll ride upon your own 2 feet without thopter or ground car or mount." And Paul had been caught more by her tone, sing-song and wavering, than by her words. "When you live upon Arrakis," she had said, "Chala, the land is empty. The moons will be your friends, the sun your enemy." Paul had sensed his mother come up beside him away from her post guarding the door. She had looked at the Reverend Mother and asked, "Do you see no hope, Your Reverence?"
"Not for the father."
And the old woman had waved Jessica to silence, looked down at Paul.
"Grave this on your memory, lad. A world is supported by 4 things.
She held up 4 big-knuckled fingers.
"The learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, and the valor of the brave. But all of these are as nothing," she closed her fingers into a fist, "without a ruler who knows the art of ruling. Make that the science of your tradition."
A week had passed since that day with the Reverend Mother. Her words were only now beginning to come into full register. Now, sitting in the training room with Thufir Hawat, Paul felt a sharp pang of fear. He looked across at the Mentat's puzzled frown.
"Where were you wool gathering that time?"
Hawat asked. "Did you meet the Reverend Mother?"
"That truth-sayer witch from the Imperium?"
Hawat's eyes quickened with interest.
"I met her."
"She..." Paul hesitated, found that he couldn't tell Hawat about the ordeal. The inhibitions went deep.
"Yes? What did she?"
Paul took 2 deep breaths. "She said a thing." He closed his eyes, calling up the words, and when he spoke, his voice unconsciously took on some of the old woman's tone.
"You, Paul Atreides, descendant of kings, son of a duke, you must learn to rule. It's something none of your ancestors learned."
Paul opened his eyes, said, "That made me angry. And I said, my father rules an entire planet, and she said, he's losing it. And I said, my father was getting a richer planet, and she said, he'll lose that one too. And I wanted to run and warn my father, but she said he'd already been warned by you, by mother, by many people."
"True enough,"
Hawat muttered. "Then why are we going?" Paul demanded.
"Because the Emperor ordered it, and because there's hope in spite of what that witch spy said. What else spouted from this ancient fountain of wisdom?"
Paul looked down at his right hand, clenched into a fist beneath the table. Slowly he willed the muscles to relax. "She put some kind of hold on me," he thought. "How?" "She asked me to tell her what it is to rule," Paul said, "and I said that one commands. And she said I had some unlearning to do."
"She hit a mark there, right enough,"
Hawat thought. He nodded for Paul to continue. "She said a ruler must learn to persuade and not to compel. She said he must lay the best coffee hearth to attract the finest men."
"How'd she figure your father attracted men like Duncan and Gurney?"
Hawat asked. Paul shrugged.
"Then she said a good ruler has to learn his world's language, that it's different for every world, and I thought she meant they didn't speak Gaelic on Arrakis, but she said that wasn't it at all. She said she meant the language of the rocks and growing things, the language you don't hear just with your ears. And I said that's what Dr. Yue calls the mystery of life."
Hawat chuckled.
"How'd that sit with her?"
"I think she got mad. She said the mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience. So I quoted the first law of Mentat at her. A process cannot be understood by stopping it. Understanding must move with the flow of the process, must join it and flow with it. That seemed to satisfy her.
He seems to be getting over it,
Hawat thought,
but that old witch frightened him. Why did she do it?
Thufir, Paul said, will Arrakis be as bad as she said?
Nothing could be that bad,
Hawat said, and forced a smile.
Take those Fremen, for example, the renegade people of the desert. By first approximation analysis, I can tell you there are many, many more of them than the Imperium suspects. People live there, lad. A great many people, and...
Howard put a sinewy finger beside his eye.
They hate Harkonnens with a bloody passion. You must not breathe a word of this, lad. I tell you only as your father's helper.
My father has told me of Seleucus Secundus, Paul said. Do you know, Thufir, it sounds much like Arrakis, perhaps not quite as bad, but much like it.
We do not really know of Seleucus Secundus today,
Howard said.
Only what it was like long ago, mostly. But what is known, you're right on that score.
Will the Fremen help us?
It's a possibility.
Hawat stood up.
I leave today for Arrakis. Meanwhile, you take care of yourself for an old man who's fond of you, eh? Come around here like the good lad and sit facing the door. It's not that I think there's any danger in the castle. It's just a habit I want you to form.
Paul got to his feet, moved around the table.
You're going today? Today it is, and you'll be following tomorrow. Next time we meet, it'll be on the soil of your new world.
He gripped Paul's right arm at the bicep.
Keep your knife arm free, eh? And your shield at full charge.
He released the arm, patted Paul's shoulder, whirled, and strode quickly to the door.
Thufir,
Paul called. Hawat turned, standing in the open doorway. Don't sit with your back to any doors, Paul said.
A grin spread across the seamed old face. That I won't, lad. Depend on it.
And he was gone, shutting the door softly behind. Paul sat down where Howard had been, straightened the papers. One more day here, he thought. He looked around the room. We're leaving. The idea of departure was suddenly more real to him than it had ever been before. He recalled another thing the old woman had said about a world being the sum of many things. The people, the dirt, the growing things, the moons, the tides, the suns. The unknown sum called nature. A vague summation without any sense of the now. And he wondered, what is the now? The door across from Paul banged open, and an ugly lump of a man lurched through it, preceded by a handful of weapons.
"Well, Gurney Halleck," Paul called, "are you the new weapons master?"
Halleck kicked the door shut with one heel.
"You'd rather I came to play games, I know," he said.
He glanced around the room, noting that Howard's men already had been over it, checking, making it safe for a duke's heir. The subtle code signs were all around. Paul watched the rolling, ugly man set himself back in motion, veer toward the training table with the load of weapons, saw the 9-string balisette slung over Gurney's shoulder with a multi-pick woven through the strings near the head of the fingerboard. Halleck dropped the weapons on the exercise table, lined them up, the rapiers, the bodkins, the kinjals, the slow pellet stunners, the shield belts. The ink-vine scar along his jawline writhed as he turned, casting a smile across the room.
"So you don't even have a good morning for me, you young imp,"
Halleck said.
"And what barb did you sink in old Hawat? He passed me in the hall like a man running to his enemy's funeral."
Paul grinned. Of all his father's men, he liked Gurney Halleck best. Knew the man's moods and deviltry, his humours, and thought of him more as a friend than as a hired sword. Halleck swung the balisette off his shoulder, began tuning it.
"If you won't talk, you won't.
he said. Paul stood, advanced across the room, calling out, "Well, Gurney, do we come prepared for music when it's fighting time?"
"So it's sass for our elders today,"
Alec said. He tried a chord on the instrument, nodded. "Where's Duncan Idaho?" Paul asked. "Isn't he supposed to be teaching me weaponry?"
"Duncan's gone to lead the second wave onto Arrakis,"
Alec said.
"All you have left is poor Gurney, who's fresh out of fight and spoiling for music."
He struck another chord, listened to it, smiled.
"And it was decided in council that you, being such a poor fighter, we'd best teach you the music trade, so as you won't waste your life entire."
"Maybe you'd better sing me a lay, then," Paul said. "I want to be sure how not to do it."
"Ah-ha!"
Gurney laughed. And he swung into Galatian Girls, his multi-pick a blur over the strings as he sang.
"Ah, the Galatian girls will do it for pearls, and the Arrakine for water. But if you desire dames like consuming flames, try a Caladanin daughter."
"Not bad for such a poor hand with a pick," Paul said. "But if my mother heard you singing a bawdy like that in the castle, she'd have your ears on the outer wall for decoration." Gurney pulled at his left ear.
"Poor decoration, too, they having been bruised so much, listening at keyholes, while a young lad I know practiced some strange ditties on his balisette."
"So you've forgotten what it's like to find sand in your bed?" Paul said. He pulled a shield belt from the table, buckled it fast around his waist.
"Then let's fight."
Halleck's eyes went wide in mock surprise.
"So, it was your wicked hand did that deed. Guard yourself today, young master. Guard yourself."
He grabbed up a rapier, laced the air with it.
"I'm a hell fiend out for revenge."
Paul lifted the companion rapier, bent it in his hands, stood in the agile, 1 foot forward. He let his manner go solemn in a comic imitation of Dr. Huey.
"What a dolt my father sends me for weaponry," Paul intoned. "This doltish Gurney Halleck has forgotten the first lesson for a fighting man armed and shielded."
Paul snapped the force button at his waist, felt the crinkled skin tingling of the defensive field at his forehead and down his back, heard external sounds take on characteristic shield-filtered flatness.
"In shield fighting, one moves fast on defense, slow on attack," Paul said. "Attack has the sole purpose of tricking the opponent into a misstep, setting him up for the attack sinister. The shield turns the fast blow, admits the slow kinjal."
Paul snapped up the rapier, feinted fast, and whipped it back for a slow thrust timed to enter a shield's mindless defenses. Halleck watched the action, turned at the last minute to let the blunted blade pass his chest.
"Speed excellent," he said, "but you are wide open for an underhanded counter with a slip-tip."
Paul stepped back, chagrined.
"I should whap your backside for such carelessness," Halleck said.
He lifted a naked kinjal from the table and held it up.
"This, in the hand of an enemy, can let out your life's blood. You're an apt pupil, none better, but I've warned you that not even in play do you let a man inside your guard with death in his hand."
"I guess I'm not in the mood for it today," Paul said.
"Mood?"
Halleck's voice betrayed his outrage even through the shield's filtering.
"What has mood to do with it? You fight when the necessity arises, no matter the mood. Mood's a thing for cattle, or making love, or playing the balisette. It's not for fighting."
"I'm sorry, Gurney."
"You're not sorry enough."
Halleck activated his own shield, crouched with kinjal outthrust in left hand, the rapier poised high in his right.
"Now I say guard yourself for true."
He leaped high to one side, then forward, pressing a furious attack. Paul fell back, parrying. He felt the field crackling as shield edges touched and repelled each other, sensed the electric tingling of the contact along his skin. "What's gotten into Gurney?" he asked himself. "He's not faking this." Paul moved his left hand, dropped his bodkin into his palm from its wrist sheath.
"You see a need for an extra blade, eh?"
Halleck grunted. "Is this betrayal?" Paul wondered. "Surely not Gurney." Around the room they fought, thrust and parry, feint and counterfeint. The air within their shield bubbles grew stale from the demands on it that the slow interchange along barrier edges couldn't replenish. With each new shield contact, the smell of ozone grew stronger. Paul continued to back, but now he directed his retreat toward the exercise table.
If I can turn him beside the table, I'll show him a trick, Paul thought. One more step, Gurney.
Halleck took the step. Paul directed a parry downward, turned, saw Halleck's rapier catch against the table's edge. Paul flung himself aside, thrust high with rapier, and came in across Halleck's neckline with the bodkin. He stopped the blade an inch from the jugular.
"Is this what you seek?"
Paul whispered.
"Look down, lad,"
Gurney panted. Paul obeyed, saw Halleck's kinjal thrust under the table's edge, the tip almost touching Paul's groin.
"We'd have joined each other in death," Halleck said. "But I'll admit you fought some better when pressed to it. You seemed to get the mood."
And he grinned wolfishly, the ink-vine scar rippling along his jaw. "The way you came at me," Paul said. "Would you really have drawn my blood?" Halleck withdrew the kinjal, straightened.
"If you'd fought one whit beneath your abilities, I'd have scratched you a good one, a scar you'd remember. I'll not have my favorite pupil fall to the first Harkonnen tramp who happens along."
Paul deactivated his shield, leaned on the table to catch his breath. "I deserved that, Gurney. But it would have angered my father if you'd hurt me. I'll not have you punished for my failing."
"As to that," Halleck said, "it was my failing, too. And you needn't worry about a training scar or two. You're lucky you have so few. As to your father, the Duke could punish me only if I failed to make a first-class fighting man out of you. And I'd have been failing there if I hadn't explained the fallacy in this mood thing you've suddenly developed."
Paul straightened, slipped his bodkin back into its wrist sheath.
"It's not exactly play we do here," Halleck said.
Paul nodded. He felt a sense of wonder at the uncharacteristic seriousness in Halleck's manner, the sobering intensity. He looked at the beet-colored ink-vine scar on the man's jaw, remembering the story of how it had been put there by Beast Raban in a Harkonnen slave pit on Gedi Prime. And Paul felt a sudden shame that he had doubted Halleck even for an instant. It occurred to Paul then that the making of Halleck's scar had been accompanied by pain, a pain as intense perhaps as that inflicted by a reverend mother. He thrust this thought aside. It chilled their world. "I guess I did hope for some play today," Paul said. "Things are so serious around here lately." Halleck turned away to hide his emotions. Something burned in his eyes. There was pain in him. Like a blister, all that was left of some lost yesterday that time had pruned off him.
"How soon this child must assume his manhood," Halleck thought. "How soon he must read that form within his mind, that contract of brutal caution, to enter the necessary fact on the necessary line. Please list your next of kin."
Halleck spoke without turning.
"I sense the play in you, lad, and I'd like nothing better than to join in it, but this no longer can be play. Tomorrow we go to Arrakis. Arrakis is real. The Harkonnens are real."
Paul touched his forehead with his rapier blade held vertical. Halleck turned, saw the salute, and acknowledged it with a nod. He gestured to the practice dummy.
"Now we'll work on your timing. Let me see you catch that thing sinister. I'll control it from over here where I can have a full view of the action, and I warn you, I'll be trying new counters today. There's a warning you'd not get from a real enemy."
Paul stretched up on his toes to relieve his muscles. He felt solemn with the sudden realization that his life had become filled with swift changes. He crossed to the dummy, slapped the switch on its chest with his rapier tip, and felt the defensive field forcing his blade away.
"En garde!"
Halleck called, and the dummy pressed the attack. Paul activated his shield, parried, and countered. Halleck watched as he manipulated the controls. His mind seemed to be in two parts— one alert to the needs of the training fight, and the other wandering in fly buzz.
"I'm the well-trained fruit tree," he thought, "full of well-trained feelings and abilities, and all of them grafted onto me, all bearing for someone else to pick."
For some reason he recalled his younger sister, her elfin face so clear in his mind. But she was dead now, in a pleasure house for Harkonnen troops. She had loved pansies, or was it daisies? He couldn't remember. It bothered him that he couldn't remember. Paul countered a slow swing of the dummy, brought up his left hand entre tissé.
The clever little devil, Halleck thought, intent now on Paul's interweaving hand motions. He's been practicing and studying on his own. That's not Duncan's style, and it's certainly nothing I've taught him.
This thought only added to Halleck's sadness.
I'm infected by mood, he thought,
and he began to wonder about Paul. If the boy ever listened fearfully to his pillow throbbing in the night.
If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets, he murmured.
It was his mother's expression, and he always used it when he felt the blackness of tomorrow on him. Then he thought what an odd expression that was to be taking to a planet that had never known seas or fishes.
Ewe, Wellington. Standard, 10,082 to 10,191. Medical doctor of the Sook School. Graduated, standard, 10,112. Married, Wana Marcus, Bene Gesserit. Standard, 10,092 to 10,186. Chiefly noted as betrayer of Duke Leto Atreides. See also Bibliography, Appendix 7, The Imperial Conditioning and Betrayal. From Dictionary of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Although he heard Dr. Ewe enter the training room, noting the stiff deliberation of the man's pace, Paul remained stretched out face down on the exercise table where the masseuse had left him. He felt deliciously relaxed after the workout with Gurney Halleck.
"You do look comfortable," said Ewe in his calm, high-pitched voice.
Paul raised his head, saw the man's stick figure standing several paces away, took in at a glance the wrinkled black clothing, the square block of a head with purple lips and drooping moustache, the diamond tattoo of imperial conditioning on his forehead, the long black hair caught in the Sook School's silver ring at the left shoulder.
"You'll be happy to hear we haven't time for regular lessons today," Ewe said. "Your father will be along presently."
Paul sat up.
"However, I've arranged for you to have a film book viewer and several lessons during the crossing to Arrakis."
"Oh." Paul began pulling on his clothes. He felt excitement that his father would be coming. They had spent so little time together since the Emperor's command to take over the fief of Arrakis. Ewe crossed to the L table, thinking, "How the boy has filled out these past few months. Such a waste. Oh, such a sad waste." And he reminded himself, "I must not falter. What I do is done to be certain my Wana no longer can be hurt by the Harkonnen beasts." Paul joined him at the table, buttoning his jacket.
"What'll I be studying on the way across?" "Ah, the tyrannic life forms of Arrakis. The planet seems to have opened its arms to certain tyrannic life forms. It's not clear how. I must seek out the planetary ecologist when we arrive at Dr. Kynes, and offer my help in the investigation."
And Ewe thought, "What am I saying? I play the hypocrite even with myself."
"Will there be something on the Fremen?" Paul asked.
"The Fremen?" Ewe drummed his fingers on the table, caught Paul staring at the nervous motion, withdrew his hand.
"Maybe you have something on the whole Arrakeen population," Paul said.
"Yes, to be sure," Ewe said. "There are two general separations of the people. Fremen, they are one group, and the others are the people of the Graben, the Sink, and the Pan. There's some intermarriage, I'm told. The women of Pan and Sink villages prefer Fremen husbands. Their men prefer Fremen wives. They have a saying, 'Polish comes from the cities, wisdom from the desert.' Do you have pictures of them? I'll see what I can get you. The most interesting feature, of course, is their eyes, totally blue. No whites in them."
"Mutation?
No, it's linked to saturation of the blood with melange. The Fremen must be brave to live at the edge of that desert. By all accounts, Yui said, they compose poems to their knives. Their women are as fierce as the men. Even Fremen children are violent and dangerous. You'll not be permitted to mingle with them, I dare say. Paul stared at Yui, finding in these few glimpses of the Fremen a power of words that caught his entire attention. What a people to win as allies. And the worms? Paul asked. What? I'd like to study more about the sandworms. Ah, to be sure. I've a film book on a small specimen, only 110 meters long and 22 meters in diameter. It was taken in the northern latitudes. Worms of more than 400 meters in length have been recorded by reliable witnesses, and there's reason to believe even larger ones exist. Paul glanced down at a conical projection chart of the northern Arakene latitudes spread on the table. The desert belt and south polar regions are marked uninhabitable. Is it the worms? And the storms? But any place can be made habitable. If it's economically feasible, Yui said. Arrakis has many costly perils. He smoothed his drooping mustache. Your father will be here soon. Before I go, I've a gift for you, something I came across in packing. He put an object on the table between them, black, oblong, no larger than the end of Paul's thumb. Paul looked at it. Yui noted how the boy didn't reach for it and thought, how cautious he is. It's a very old orange Catholic Bible made for space travelers, not a film book, but actually printed on filament paper. It has its own magnifier and electrostatic charge system. He picked it up, demonstrated. The book is held closed by the charge, which forces against spring-locked covers. You press the edge, thus, and the pages you've selected repel each other and the book opens. It's so small. But it has 1,800 pages. You press the edge, thus, and so, and the charge moves ahead one page at a time as you read. Never touch the actual pages with your fingers. The filament tissue is too delicate. He closed the book, handed it to Paul. Try it. Yui watched Paul work the page adjustment, thought, I salve my own conscience. I give him the surcease of religion before betraying him. Thus may I say to myself that he has gone where I cannot go. This must have been made before film books, Paul said. It's quite old. Let it be our secret, eh? Your parents might think it too valuable for one so young. And Yui thought, his mother would surely wonder at my motives. Well, Paul closed the book, held it in his hand. If it's so valuable, indulge an old man's whim, Yui said. It was given to me when I was very young. And he thought, I must catch his mind as well as his cupidity. Open it to 467 Kalima, where it says, From water does all life begin. There's a slight notch at the edge of the cover to mark the place. Paul felt the cover, detected two notches, one shallower than the other. He pressed the shallower one, and the book spread open on his palm, its magnifier sliding into place. Read it aloud, Yui said. Paul wet his lips with his tongue, read, Think you of the fact that a deaf person cannot hear? Then what deafness may we not all possess? What senses do we lack that we cannot see and cannot hear another world all around us? What is there around us that we cannot... Stop it! Yui barked. Paul broke off, stared at him. Yui closed his eyes, fought to regain composure. What perversity caused the book to open at my Wana's favorite passage? He opened his eyes, saw Paul staring at him. Is something wrong? Paul asked. I'm sorry, Yui said. That was my dead wife's favorite passage. It's not the one I intended you to read. It brings up memories that are painful. There are two notches, Paul said.
Of course, Yui thought. Wanna marked her passage. His fingers are more sensitive than mine and found her mark. It was an accident, no more.
You may find the book interesting, Yui said. It has much historical truth in it as well as good ethical philosophy.
Paul looked down at the tiny book in his palm. Such a small thing, yet it contained a mystery. Something had happened while he read from it. He had felt something stir his terrible purpose.
"Your father will be here any minute," Yui said. "Put the book away, and read it at your leisure."
Paul touched the edge of it as Yui had shown him. The book sealed itself. He slipped it into his tunic. For a moment there, when Yui had barked at him, Paul had feared the man would demand the book's return.
"I thank you for the gift, Dr. Yui," Paul said, speaking formally. "It will be our secret. If there is a gift, a favor you wish from me, please do not hesitate to ask."
"I need for nothing," Yui said, and he thought, "Why do I stand here torturing myself, and torturing this poor lad, though he doesn't know it? Oh, yeah. Damn those Harkonnen beasts. Why did they choose me for their abomination?"
How do we approach the study of Muad'Dib's father? A man of surpassing warmth and surprising coldness was the Duke Leto Atreides. Yet many facts open the way to this duke. His abiding love for his Bene Gesserit lady, the dreams he held for his son, the devotion with which men served him. You see him there, a man snared by destiny, a lonely figure with his light dimmed behind the glory of his son. Still, one must ask, what is the son but an extension of the father? From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries, by the Princess Irulan.
Paul watched his father enter the training room, saw the guards take up stations outside. One of them closed the door. As always, Paul experienced a sense of presence in his father, someone totally here. The Duke was tall, olive-skinned. His thin face held harsh angles, warmed only by deep gray eyes. He wore a black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast. A silvered shield belt with the patina of much use girded his narrow waist. The Duke said, "Hard at work, son?" He crossed to the L table, glanced at the papers on it, swept his gaze around the room and back to Paul. He felt tired, filled with the ache of not showing his fatigue. "I must use every opportunity to rest during the crossing to Arrakis," he thought. "There'll be no rest on Arrakis."
"Not very hard," Paul said. "Everything's so..."
He shrugged. "Yes, well, tomorrow we leave. It'll be good to get settled in our new home, put all this upset behind." Paul nodded, suddenly overcome by memory of the Reverend Mother's words, "For the father, nothing."
"Father," Paul said, "will Arrakis be as dangerous as everyone says?"
The Duke forced himself to the casual gesture, sat down on a corner of the table, smiled. A whole pattern of conversation welled up in his mind, the kind of thing he might use to dispel the vapors in his men before a battle. The pattern froze before it could be vocalized, confronted by the single thought, "This is my son."
"It'll be dangerous," he admitted. "Hawat tells me we have a plan for the Fremen," Paul said, and he wondered, "Why don't I tell him what that old woman said? How did she seal my tongue?"
The Duke noted his son's distress, said,
"As always, Hawat sees the main chance, but there's much more. I see also the Combine Honet Ober Advancer Mercantiles, the Chom Company. By giving me Arrakis, His Majesty is forced to give us a Chom directorship, a subtle gain."
"Chom controls the spice," Paul said.
"And Arrakis with its spice is our avenue into Chom," the Duke said.
There's more to charm than melange. Did the Reverend Mother warn you? Paul blurted. He clenched his fists, feeling his palms slippery with perspiration. The effort it had taken to ask that